What makes you think you can build anything, much less a world?
The question didn't upset Sam. His expression became vague and preoccupied.
I am not too young to be a god, am I?
You're just a boy.
Sam nodded in grudging agreement.
A boy who doesn't age, but who evolves, who possesses all the wisdom from the beginning of time. But no one has ever been as alone as I. So I must build my own world, where I will never be alone again.
And how will you do that?
By making everyone who ever lived, whoever will live, a part of me, and me a part of them.
Grant stood frozen, inwardly shrinking from the quiet self-confidence in the young man's tone and bearing. Sam put his hands in the pockets of his blazer and looked down at the toes of his spotless white shoes.
I know what happened to the cities in the Black Gobi, to Karakoto, to Sumer, to the civilization of Angkor, to the temples of the Maya and the Aztec. Somehow I know, and because I do know, that isolates me. I was born alone. No one in history has ever been as alone as I.
He glanced up, staring intently at Grant as if seeing him for the first time.
How did you find out about this place, Mr. Grant? Do you know what I'm doing here?
What makes you think I know anything about anything?
Sam's mouth twisted in mockery.
Oh, yes. Of course, you know nothing. Naturally, you must deny knowing anything about anything. About the perfectly unique aircraft you were flying. About the hows and whys of your just happening to be flying it over this province in Assam. About whether I can expect your friends, Mr. Grant or Miss Baptiste, or even Mohandas Lakesh Singh, to drop in at any moment.
Judging by your missile and radar emplacements, it wasn't like you never foresaw something like that happening.
I believe in being prepared to deal with all contingencies.
I've heard that about you.
Sam stepped farther into the room.
Really? What else have you heard?
Grant refused to reply. He only shook his head.
The fact you have not asked me any questions tells me you know quite a bit about my affairs. Far, far more than you should by any laws of logic. You know where you are, don't you?
Grant didn't move or speak. His face remained impassive.
I suppose I could tell you a few things. For example, before another month is out, almost all of Assam will be under my control. Before another month and a half passes, that quaint little mountaintop retreat of yours will be destroyed.
All right, Sam. I do know a few things, some of which you don't know, but really want to know. But I'll expect to receive some information from you, too. For example, what's so special about Assam?
Sam's golden eyes glinted with sudden humor.
Very little, except for its long historical association with a variety of tantric sex cults. At this point, it's a culture dish, in more ways than one.
I don't get you.
Perhaps it would be more accurate to refer to Assam as my laboratory, wherein I gather empirical data about the human race's primary motivators. For example, humanity functions by responding to the overwhelming commands of its visceral needs and its survival. Humankind's single most overriding need is to eat, so at the head of my data list is to induce hunger. It's simple, isn't it? Eat or die.
Grant nodded, wishing the young man would come close enough so he could launch a kick.
Yes, that's simple enough.
Then, when a belly is full, sex assumes the dominant position of visceral demands. As far as your kind is concerned, sex transcends simple procreative needs. You find it satisfying, intoxicating. Every human society throughout your sordid history has followed this basic pattern. I meet these two basic drives with the Naroda movement. This country, this province, is only a pilot experiment. I'll be exporting it abroad soon enough.
Grant nodded casually.
I figured as much. You need to test the audience before you fully draft your so-called great plan.
Sam's lean body suddenly seemed to freeze. His expression did not alter. His eyes did not blink. His hands did not move. He did not appear to breathe.
Now that is interesting, Mr. Grant. How could you possibly have heard those two words in connection to me?
His eyes shone brightly, hot aureate pools of suspicion and anger. Grant tried to shrug, even though the motion pained him.
I have my connections, Sammy.
What are they? What brought you here? Have I been betrayed? Did my mother...
He bit off the rest of his question, as if he could not bring himself to utter it.
Who the hell would betray you? Nobody gives enough of a shit about you.
You are so very, very wrong about that, Mr. Grant.
He turned his head and called to someone outside the room.
You may come in now. I'm afraid I'll need you after all.
Instantly, a woman stepped into the room, moving with a lithe, danceresque grace. Grant had expected to see Erica Van Sloan, but he didn't recognize the dark-haired woman who responded to Sam's summons. However, he recognized her as a type. She was a hybrid, and a stirringly beautiful one, too. Grant noticed immediately that she was nearly a half-head taller than most hybrids he had seen. The long, sleek hair that framed her high-planed face and her dark, back-slanted eyes gave her an exotic, almost barbaric flair. She wore the black imperial uniform, the satin tunic stretched taut over her small breasts and cinched tight at her very narrow waist. She carried a slender silver wand, which tapered down to a very narrow tip. Grant's belly turned cold when he recognized it as an infrasound wand.
This is Baron Beausoleil, also known as Scorpio Prime.
By great effort, Grant managed to keep the astonishment he felt from registering on his face. He knew Domi had encountered the female Baron at Ayers Rock during the mission to rescue Quavel, but he hadn't expected to ever see her face to face. Just the concept of a female Baron was surprising enough, so actually seeing her in the flesh was almost shocking.
The Baron enjoys wringing answers from mysteries. She has been a great comfort and help to me in my various endeavors.
As Sam spoke, Beausoleil absently swished the rod back and forth. Grant was assailed by an instant of irrational dread. He knew the infrasound batons converted electrical current to sound waves by a maser, and were very deadly weapons. He had been on the receiving end of their kinetic punch once before, and it had taken him days to recover.
Mr. Grant, I want you to tell me how you came to be here. After all, you owe me a little consideration. I could have left you to die in your aircraft.
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Try us.
We received a message from the future. It laid out your entire great plan, how you intend to starve the world, infest it with a plague, then set up the Naroda movement and stage a devastating war. By the time you're all done with it, you'll have built the world you talked about. You'll never be alone again, because you'll be linked with every human brain alive on the planet.
Ah.
Sam nodded as if he had expected the answer. He nodded to Beausoleil and then to Grant.
If you would be so kind.
The woman danced forward and slashed Grant viciously across the left cheek with the point of the infrasound wand. Fortunately, it wasn't powered up. If it had been, most of his facial bones would have been fractured. As it was, the unexpected force of the blow staggered him. If not for the chain at his waist, he would have fallen.
The Imperator put some simple questions to you, Mr. Grant. He expects you to answer them, and if you do not, he expects me to compel you to do so.
He's liable to be very disappointed.
Sam turned toward the door.
I'll leave you two alone. I have the sunrise ceremony to arrange.
Hey, Sammy?
The young man paused, turning his head to look at him. Grant dug the toes of his right foot into a puddle of fetid muck and kicked a slurry of slime in his direction. Sam didn't get all of it, but his spotless white coat was spattered with dark brown-green splotches.
Ugh.
Grant kicked at Beausoleil, who danced back out of the way of his big muddy foot with a step that was surprisingly swift. In the same motion, she thumbed on the power switch of the wand. The humming, shivering tip of the wand inscribed a short arc and swiped him across the ankle. Crying out, Grant reeled backward, a numbing pain running up and down his leg.
That wasn't even not to have power.
Get answers out of that son of a bitch. Do whatever you have to do.
He whirled through the door and was gone. Baron Beausoleil flashed Grant a very smug, self-satisfied smile. He tried to straighten, favoring his right foot. He didn't think the ankle bone was broken, but the nerves in it felt as if they had been dipped in acid. Beausoleil slowly ran her gaze up and down his body, eyeing him speculatively.
You are a superb physical specimen for an apeling.
She extended the vibrating tip of the infrasound wand toward his genitals, continuing to smile at him. He resisted the urge to cup his hands over his groin. Even if the length of the chains encumbering his wrists allowed it, he knew it would do very little good. Having been on the receiving end of the ultrasonic kicks delivered by the wands, he knew how quickly they could disable. He recalled how the focused energy had once liquefied a hybrid's brain. The notion of what it could do to his testicles caused cold sweat to break out all over his body.
You have a true man's physique. Strong, powerful, virile. It's a pity sex holds no appeal for me. A pity for you.
Grant did his best not to let the fear filling him show on his face. If Domi was tempestuous in her passions and Shizuka a fierce warrior queen, then Beausoleil was a terrifying symbol of female power. She was more predator than woman, driven by a lust that could only be satisfied by pain and blood. She did not just want it, she demanded it. The point of the Baron's little wet red tongue popped out and touched her lips as she stepped closer, the tip of the baton humming like a swarm of insects. Beads of sweat ran down his backbone.
There's no point to this. There's nothing I can tell you.
On your knees before your Baron.
The fear in Grant didn't exactly ebb, but it was replaced by a stronger, hotter emotion. He felt his face locking into a mask of angry resolve.
No.
The tip of the rod stabbed forward, touching his left shoulder. Grant jerked at the sting of it against his bruised flesh.
Hurts just a little, doesn't it?
Then she began flailing at him with the wand, using it with skill and speed and sadistic expertise. A series of nerve-shredding shocks tore at his body. Through a red mist of agony, Grant twisted, fought the restraint of his bonds. He didn't try to snatch at the wand. Not until the vicious bitch was within his reach did he dare act.
Why did you come here?
The point of the wand struck before Grant could answer, stroking his knee, his stomach, his chest.
Answer me, you apekin scum! Answer!
Despite the agony consuming him, Grant understood the interrogation technique. Baron Beausoleil had probably picked it up from her Ville's Magistrate Division. Questions followed by the application of pain, then more questions with no opportunity for answers. It was a standard mag practice, meant to break the spirit and encourage unthinking responses. Grant refused to answer or to be broken, even though the wand seared his nerves, bruised his flesh and muscle, and ruptured capillaries all over his body.
Told you already.
Do you expect me to believe that idiocy about a message from the future?
Baron Beausoleil's eyes blazed with a wild light and perspiration slicked her face.
Do you take me for a fool?
No. You're a diseased little slut.
The Baron tensed with rage, her face taut as she raised the infrasound wand, holding it like a rapier, the humming tip circling inches from Grant's eyes.
Do you think you can be as uncooperative without the use of your eyes? Don't you know how easy it would be? Pop, pop, and you're blind for life!
Beausoleil had worked herself up to a mad fury, converting it to pleasure, taking almost orgasmic enjoyment in the pain, the fear she caused.
Do you know where you are? Where the cultists put their garbage, their sewage. Because that's all you really are, your entire species. Only secretions and excrement.
And what does that make you? Since you're spending so much time with me, that makes you a sanitation expert, doesn't it? A sewer worker?
Baron Beausoleil's cold marble face didn't alter. She extended the shivering tip of the wand until it touched his forehead. Like a bolt of lightning, pain ripped through Grant's nervous system. His brain seemed to catch fire, electric with agony. He writhed and convulsed, the links of the chains clinking and rattling. He was only dimly aware of sagging in his chains, the manacles cutting cruelly into his wrists. His head hung loosely. All he could see was the damp ground and the toes of Beausoleil's polished boots.
How much longer will you allow this to go on? Until you're blind? Crippled? Impotent?
Grant had no breath or inclination to answer. He could barely move. Even blinking brought pain, and respiration was an exercise in agony.
As you wish. As you wish.
The wand's bee swarm hum grew louder, filling his ears. Then the room seemed to move as if a giant boot had given the foundation a ferocious kick. Grant heard objects falling over and the ceiling cracked, showering the room with dust and grit. The light bulb exploded with a crackle and a spray of sparks. Then Grant dared to act. Avanisa didn't like guns, particularly not the spindly machine guns called SIG-AMTs that had been doled out by the Scorpio Prime's foreign minions. He much preferred his own rawhide 12-plated whip as a symbol and tool of discipline and violence. He took a secret pride in the knowledge that the whip itself marked him as an overseer, not the colored uniform or the face paint with the scorpion insignia. Unlike most of the Naga people, Avanisa was a gnarled, knot-muscled little man, stringy and lean, like a half-starved cat. A shag of iron-gray beard clothed his lower face. His hair was just as gray, but at least the red and black turban covered that. His skin was as dark and tough as cured leather, and his obsidian eyes glinted from nests of wrinkles. As much as he prided himself on the whip, he took a great deal of satisfaction in believing his eyes saw everything. In the hour preceding dawn, Avanisa roused the slaves from their barracks, ordering them down to the riverbank to bathe and make themselves presentable for the weekly benediction performed by the High Priestess of Shakti. The blessing bestowed by the servant of the Scorpio Prime was meant to inspire the workers to labor with more dedication in the restoration of the temple. As far as Avanisa was concerned, more food and fewer hours toiling in the brutal heat would accomplish that, with no man-hours wasted on pseudo-religious ceremonies. A bit of consideration given to the limitations of human endurance would greatly improve morale. At the moment, morale was in a precarious balance. Two of the young slaves had escaped from the barracks the evening before, stealing a canoe and taking it down the Brahmaputra. He had dispatched a retrieval party, but they had yet to return. Although he didn't find their absence particularly significant, since he knew they wouldn't try to come back upriver at night, he knew the other slaves were anxiously waiting to learn if the escapees would be returned after daybreak. If they were not, then Avanisa feared the pair of young people would become heroes, sources of inspiration. As it was, he had already heard murmurs among the laborers that Shiva was greatly displeased by the defilement of the Temple of Shakti and would soon intervene. Those murmurs had become pronounced after the strange events of only a few hours before, when the spear of the Scorpio Prime pierced a flying machine, like Shiva's Vimana mentioned in the Ramayana, and brought it to Earth. Avanisa wasn't a superstitious or religious man. He didn't necessarily disbelieve in the gods or the old ways, but by the same token, he had a great appreciation for reality. And at this point, the simple reality was that the Scorpio Prime held the reins of power in Goalpara. She saw to the feeding and clothing of the people and their entertainment. Whether she was really an incarnation of Shakti or not, all Avanisa cared about was whether he ate and was laid on a regular schedule. So far, the Scorpio Prime hadn't let him down. Avanisa and three of his fellow Nagas watched as the people clustered at the water at the riverbank, washing and grooming themselves so their stench wouldn't be an affront to the Scorpio Prime's High Priestess, a tall foreign bitch who behaved as if everything in Assam was an affront to her. So he waited in the pre-dark murk for the 28 people to complete their ablutions. When it seemed they were taking an inordinately long time, he barked a command and cracked his whip in the air to catch their attention. Slowly but obediently, the slaves began trudging up the slight incline, the women drawing closed their saris and the hoods of their robes. In a tight mass, they marched toward the temple. Avanisa led them past the irrigation ditches and the work tables. The eastern horizon glowed with red-gold bands when they entered the temple through a courtyard full of shadows and overgrown shrubbery. Cracked pillars thrust up their pinnacles into the sky, some of them topped by eroded, horrific faces of demons. The entrance foyer was partly fallen in, but the portico, upheld by four marble columns, was still intact. Along the edge of the roof, a row of horn-headed stone gargoyles leered down, statues of monsters of bygone epochs, half-human and half-beast. Inside the temple, Avanisa followed the distant thumping of drums, and the people followed him. From a wide corridor, they walked into the vast central hall serving as the Temple of Shakti. The area was illuminated by flaming braziers and lanterns that threw a shimmering veil of color over the walls, which depicted passion-twisted figures locked in a wide variety of sexual positions. The High Priestess stood upon the round altar stone, slowly beating a drum with one hand. Her features were painted in red and black designs, her long black hair tossed over a shoulder in a thick braid, intertwined with garlands of flowers. Her graceful, swan-like neck led to a voluptuous body draped in a thin, gauzy silk that only blurred but did not obscure her long legs and firm, round breasts. taut nipples pressed against the thin fabric as if she were in a high state of sexual arousal. Avanisa stood aside as the slaves filed into the chamber. He wasn't particularly anxious to attend the benediction, since the ceremony would end only with distribution of bowls of rice, not with an orgy. The Scorpia Prime herself was not present, and therefore such activity would not be proper. As one of the female slaves strode by him, body wrapped in a sari from head to ankle, Avanisa noted absently that she didn't shuffle. He also caught a brief flash of white from beneath the linen hood. It required a moment for the anomalies to register fully, and by then most of the laborers had crowded into the temple. Suspicions flaring, Avanisa shouted an order and all the people lurched to a halt. The overseer ignored the glare of disapproval from the high priestess as his eyes swept over the bowed, linen-covered heads. He pulled a laborer from the line, more or less at random, and yanked the hood back, revealing the frightened, seamed face of a middle-aged woman. Avanisa pushed the woman aside and stepped to the next person in line, a small figure he guessed was a teenager. He pulled her hood back roughly and gaped at the white-skinned, white-haired, red-eyed devil who smiled sweetly up at him. He started to bellow an alarm. Then Domi shot him right through her sari. The .45 caliber round caught the bearded man Mahdi had identified as Avanisa dead center, crushing his clavicle and ripping both of his lungs apart. The overseer didn't cry out, but just left his feet, catapulting backward into one of the freestanding braziers. It toppled over amid a storm of sparks, clanging loudly against the stone floor. The slaves, many of them clapping hands over their ears, fell into a mindless panic, despite being told earlier by Mahdi what the three outlanders had in mind. The laborers had been overjoyed to see them in the girl's company when they floated to the riverbank. They were ecstatic when Mahdi explained they intended to free them from servitude and were more than eager to help smuggle them into the temple. Now, with the death of their cruel overseer, they screamed and ran in all directions at once. The few who didn't milled around aimlessly, unsure how to react. Kane knew the sound of the gunshot would draw other Scorpia Prime soldiers into the temple. He pushed Lakesh toward the altar.
Grab Erica!
The High Priestess, standing frozen by shock on the altar stone, dropped the drum. Lakesh saw the light of recognition dawn in her overly made-up eyes as he fought his way through the terrified workers toward her. His feet tangled in the hem of the robe hanging from his shoulders, and he stumbled, falling to the floor. He managed to catch himself with both hands, but before he could lever himself upright again, a frantic slave stepped on him, using his back as a springboard and slamming him face first to the floor. Cursing, Lakesh got to his feet in a lunging rush, elbowing two people aside. He ripped off his robe as he did so, catching only the briefest glimpses of Erica Van Sloan racing toward a narrow doorway at the rear of the chamber. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Domi and Kane struggling out of their robes. At the same time, a group of turbaned, face-painted men pounded into the temple, the barrels of the subguns in their hands spitting flame and thunder. Three of the workers screamed and fell, clutching at themselves. Kane caught Lakesh's eye.
Go!
As the last of the slaves ran screaming from the temple, Domi and Kane reacted instantaneously, reflexively. Simultaneously, they depressed the triggers and their handguns roared. A turbaned soldier's cry of warning ended in a gargled grunt as the 9mm blockbusters from Kane's Sin Eater tore blood-bursting gouges in his throat and knocked him backward. Miniature volcanoes erupted crimson geysers all over his torso. The six warriors rushing into the temple uttered wild, ululating screams, shouldering their SIG AMTs. The Nagas, savages though they might be, had an instinctive grasp of tactics. They spread out across the area, some trying to cut their quarry off from a retreat. Shots cracked and boomed. A bullet hissed past Kane's ear, and another tugged at the collar of his shadow suit. He dived behind a carved pillar that displayed a relief image of a menage a trois among a man, a woman, and a cobra, his finger depressing the trigger of his Sin Eater. Three bullets took the right ear off the head of a Scorpia Prime soldier, bit deeply into his neck and hammered him between the eyes, blowing out the back of his turban in a gout of blood, bone chips, and brain matter. Domi went to her knees behind the altar stone, and her semi-automatic pistol thundered as she chose her targets carefully. A pair of .45 caliber slugs hit a man bearing a long, wavy-bladed dagger with a hollow-point 1-2 punch, knocking him backward. A barrage of bullets spewed from two subguns thudding into the stone, chopping out fragments but not penetrating it. Domi kept her head down and continued working the trigger of her pistol. The thunder of the gunfire was deafening. The walls of the huge chamber beat it back and magnified it. A keening Naga raced directly for Kane's position, swinging a curved sword over his head and working the trigger of a SIG AMT. Kane shifted the barrel of his Sin Eater and let loose a tri-burst. The warrior doubled over, bleeding from three wounds in his belly. He fell face down at the base of the column, right beneath the stone representation of a male sexual organ. A lucky bullet knocked a dust-spurting gouge from the altar stone, sweeping Domi's face with stinging rock particles and drawing blood.
Ow, fuck!
She fired the combat master in return. Two rounds pounded the man who had scored the lucky shot off his feet, his limbs twisting and convulsing. She knew she needed to reload. Then she saw Kane still laying down a left-to-right pattern of fire, pitch a metal ball with his left hand.
Rim!
He ducked behind the pillar and buried his face in his arms. Domi dropped flat, arms over her head, bracing herself for the explosion. One of the turban soldiers saw the object bouncing across the ground, and he opened his mouth to scream a warning. The detonation of the incendiary grenade hurled fire-wreathed bodies into the air, the concussion shattering bones and rupturing internal organs. A fine rain of dirt, pulverized pebbles, and droplets of blood drizzled down. Domi and Kane looked up and saw a warrior thrashing around in blind agony, screaming as he tried to beat out the phosphorus flames on his clothes and hair. Kane shot him quickly, one merciful bullet to the head. He and Domi climbed to their feet, surveying the kill zone with swift, appraising stares. The unit of Scorpia Prime soldiers was thoroughly neutralized, their bodies scattered like broken, bloody dolls. The air held a throat-closing reek of smoke and cordite. The sweet odor of seared human flesh made both people want to hold their noses. Domi looked behind them worriedly.
There may be lots more soldiers in this place, and Lakesh is unarmed. We need to find him and see if he's okay.
A wedge of Scorpia Prime warriors drove into the temple from the opposite end of the wall in a milling rush. Their subguns were out, and when they caught sight of the outlanders, they shouted commands. The warriors behind them began to fan out warily but swiftly. Domi and Kane sprinted swiftly through the doorway that Lakesh had run through. Domi plucked a grin from her war bag, slipped the spoon, and lobbed it around the curve in the wall. Eyes wide and fearful, the Naga soldiers dug in their heels and tried to stop, but the men behind them continued to push them onward. The sound of the explosion instantly bled into a grinding rumble of a stony mass shifting. The groaning grate overlapped the ringing echoes of the detonation, then overwhelmed it. The grinding noise expanded into a rumbling roar. As Kane and Domi watched, a long section of the high ceiling was riven through with ugly black fissures, spreading out in a spiderweb pattern. It seemed to crack open like overripe fruit. Then the ceiling split in the middle and folded downward like a double lid. It fell into the temple in a crushing torrent of bouncing blocks and spurting dust. All the Scorpia Prime soldiers were engulfed by the tons of collapsing basalt and sandstone. The round altar was shattered and half-buried. Kane and Domi stepped quickly away from the doorway, shielding their faces from ricocheting chunks of stone. After the rolling echo of the crash faded, there came a stunned silence. Grit-laden dust hung in the air like a blanket over the fallen mass of rock.
So much for restoration.
Domi's eyes glinted.
We haven't done enough yet. Find Lakesh, find what happened to Grant, then we do more.
Let's start on that right now.
As the explosion rocked the foundations of the fortress, causing little showers of dust to sift down from above, Baron Beausoleil gaped up at the ceiling, eyes wide with astonishment. Grant lunged forward, using his massive legs as springs. The slack of the chain on his waist snapped out taut and straight as the crown of his head caught the woman in the midsection. The impact was not as full-on as he had hoped, but still, Beausoleil careened backward, her arms windmilling. The silver baton flew from her fingers and landed with a splash in a puddle of sludge. The vibration sent slime splashing in all directions. Teeth set on a groan of pain, Grant leaned forward as far as he could, balanced on his toes. With tendon-straining effort, he extended his right hand and managed to pull the infrasound wand from the semi-fluid pool of muck. As he did so, he saw Baron Beausoleil push herself to her feet, her lips writhing over her small, perfect teeth as she tried to pull in oxygen. She clutched at her belly as she staggered erect. Grant thumbed the wand's power switch to full output. The humming drone became a high-pitched buzz. He touched the vibration-blurred tip to the chains hooked to his manacles. The link split and fell with chiming sounds like the ringing of distant bells. He twisted around to break the chain connected to the metal belt at his waist and free himself from the wall. Just as the link snapped apart, sickening pain burst up through his testicles like an explosion. He dropped the infrasound wand and clutched at his crotch, folding in the direction of the white-hot agony. Through pain-fogged eyes, he saw Baron Beausoleil snatch at the wand on the ground, and he swatted at her, trying to drive her back. Beausoleil's right leg came up in a lethal kick. The toe of her boot caught Grant under the chin with surprising force. He fell over backward and fought the urge to huddle up into a ball. Moving on sheer hatred and desperation, he rolled away, knowing as he did so, she had retrieved the infrasound wand. Through the blood thundering in his ears, he heard her voice.
Long ago, long before you were born, I learned all of your kind's weak and vulnerable points, and just how to mete out pain as well as tolerate it.
With the wall at his back, Grant pushed himself to his feet, breathing deeply between clenched teeth. With a cold, mocking smile on her face, Baron Beausoleil fainted with the wand, but Grant didn't rise to the bait. He slid to the left, his back pressed against the rough stone of the wall. The Baron advanced slowly, thrusting with the baton toward Grant's face. Instead of recoiling, Grant took a swift sidestep back toward the right. The motion disconcerted Beausoleil, who didn't have the time to get her weapon back in line for another straight-on attack, and she struck out in a poorly aimed backhand. Leaning away from the clumsy blow, Grant's right hand shot out and closed around the woman's slender wrist. He pivoted at the same time on the ball of his right foot. He pulled Baron Beausoleil forward, hooking his left arm over the woman's shoulder. Keeping his weight on the pivot foot, he extended his left leg between the Baron's feet. With an outraged screech, she fell heavily to the muddy floor, but she maintained her grip on the wand, and Grant maintained a vice-like grip on the woman's wrist, grinding the bone. Grant stared into her eyes.
Tolerate this.
He brought the Baron's elbow across his knee with such force that the joint snapped with a sound like a stick of green wood breaking. She screamed with agony, and her fingers opened around the handle of the baton. It rolled across the floor, but Grant made no move to pick it up. Instead, he fitted his hand around the slender column of the woman's throat and began to squeeze. Lakesh sprinted flat out down the corridor, Erica Van Sloan's pale figure little more than a wispy wraith in the shadowed dimness. The passageway was very plain, with no carvings, no statuary, no frescoes anywhere in sight. He wondered absently if the Mughal builders had felt the temple itself was sufficiently ornate for anyone's tastes. Lungs straining, Lakesh called out to her.
Erica, this is ridiculous. I won't hurt you. I'm not armed.
Erica Van Sloan ran for a few paces, then slowed and leaned against the wall, drinking in air. She stared at Lakesh with suspicious eyes as he stumbled to a halt near her. The gown she wore draped her figure in such a way that the fabric stretched tight over the mounds of her breasts, the swell of her hips and thighs. It was a garment designed to enhance femininity, and there was nothing soft about the expression on her face or in her eyes.
What the fuck are you doing here, Singh?
Lakesh smiled condescendingly.
A little more formal now than the last time we saw each other.
Fear and fury warred for dominance in Erica's voice and bearing.
How did you get here?
He shrugged, approaching her. She moved away from him, lips compressed.
You think you can stop Sam?
Lakesh's smile broadened.
By my calculations, he's already been stopped. The timeline has been altered just enough so his dreams of an adaptive Earth can never be realized. At least not by the method of staging a war and creating a phony religion.
Erica's overly made-up eyes widened in surprise.
This? It's only a small loss. Sam can deal with it and go on to the next phase. He's free of all the poisons that degrade the rest of us. He has the tools he needs to reshape the world.
Tools like you? That's all you are to him, you know. Once you're worn out, you'll be discarded.
So self-righteous.
Lakesh whirled at the sound of Sam's voice, heart suddenly pounding within his chest. The young man in white bared his teeth in either a grin or a grimace.
You're also my tool. I thought you understood that, Mohandas.
I understand about the nanites that you used to make me fairly youthful again.
Lakesh saw the cold, sneering mask of Erica Van Sloan's face change a little.
You didn't tell her, did you, that your Fountain of Youth miracle had nothing to do with energy, but was due to the introduction of molecular machines into her body?
Sam half turned to Erica.
Does it matter how it was done, Mother? You're young, beautiful, and vital again, commanding far more power and influence than you ever did in your former life.
Tell her the rest, Sam.
The rest?
Not only is he not human, but he's a mass murderer, a destroyer of souls. He's the latest incarnation of a conniving monster that has walked Earth for eons.
Lakesh cocked his head at Sam.
Tell me, Imperator, what will happen to you if you do manage to build your adaptive Earth and everyone on it dies? Will you go on living, trapped forever in an immortal body, your program running on automatic?
Sam's eyes were veiled and remote.
You misjudge me. I want only the opportunity to open minds, to seek affinity between them, thought to thought, dream to dream.
No. You want to open minds so you can empty them and put your own thoughts and dreams in there.
Would that be so horrible? Think of the wonders the human race will accomplish, free of all their visceral emotions.
I think of all the horrors they will commit, with their minds as merciless and cold as yours.
It's not like that at all.
Then tell me.
Sam opened his mouth, closed it, and smiled again.
It's my game, Mohandas. If you're not going to join my team, then you have to figure it out for yourself. And while you're at it, you can figure out how much longer you have to live.
Agony washed over Lakesh in a wave, deep, boring pains in his chest, in his legs, and then a fire burning behind his eyes. He was only dimly aware of crying out and falling to the floor. He felt similar pain in the same areas of his body as before, where he had undergone surgeries to replace knee joints with polyethylene, a lung and heart transplant, and where his glaucoma-afflicted brown eyes were changed out for bright new blue ones. The nanites were attacking the weakest parts of his body on a molecular level, sending him writhing across the corridor floor in pain. Through the squall of pain roaring within the walls of his skull, he heard Sam's voice.
I will concede my defeat on this occasion, Mohandas, but it's only a small move in a far larger game. But I'm the game master, and it's up to me whether I'll keep you alive to contend against me another day, or kill you at a whim. I have plenty of time to make up my mind.
Lakesh groaned again, but with utter fear. He blinked to clear his vision, then felt small, soft hands touching his face and heard gentle words, soothing and tender. Vision slowly clearing, he saw he lay on his back, his head cradled in Domi's lap. The fear he felt before was nothing to the terror that consumed him at the sight of her. He groped for her hand, knowing at any second he could age 50 years and never know her touch again. Domi understood his sudden fear, and she smiled down on him.
It's all right, Lakesh. We'll always have plenty of time.
Red and black madness overwhelmed Grant's thoughts. He could think of nothing else but killing the monster who had tried to humiliate and kill him. Very dimly, on the edges of his awareness, he thought he heard Kane shouting his name. Then he realized Kane was hammering at his wrists and forearms, trying to pry his fingers from Baron Beausoleil's neck. The pain of his blows was drowned in his hatred, which in turn became pain.
Stop it! Let her go! We can use her! Do you understand? We can use her!
Finally, Grant allowed himself to be borne backward by Kane. Baron Beausoleil lay on the ground, twitching fitfully, breathing in little gasps, barely conscious. Grant sagged within the arms of his friend, totally exhausted, so worn out by pain and fatigue all he could do was stare at the Baron's body.
Can you walk? Think so.
Kane steadied him on his feet, released him, then knelt beside the Baron, swiftly examining her. He had guessed who she was based on Domi's description.
The temple is on fire and will probably be falling apart in a few minutes. Domi went after Lakesh, but whether she finds him or not, we've got to get out of here, fast.
Grant nodded numbly. Kane heaved Baron Beausoleil's body over a shoulder and strode out of the cell. He pointed out Grant's shadow suit lying just outside the door, wadded up on the floor. He waited impatiently while Grant drew it on. By the time they were halfway down the passageway, Grant's step was more sure and firm, even though he limped. By the time they found the way out, the palace was in flames. Apparently, the incendiary grenade had ignited various flammables and the fire had quickly spread. Smoke lay in heavy sheets and boiled out of windows. Flames licked from every opening. Lakesh and Domi were waiting for them in the courtyard. Kane cut off their questions, particularly those about the hybrid female slung over his shoulder. He hustled them outside the walls, where most of the former slaves were assembled, Mahdi among them. The sun was only a hand span above the horizon, the sky ablaze with brilliant molten colors only slightly less muted than those of the flame sheets spurting from the Temple of Shakti. Kane dropped Baron Beausoleil unceremoniously on the ground, where she lay unconscious, the marks of Grant's fingers discoloring her throat. He turned to Grant.
What did that bitch do to you to make you try to strangle her?
She showed me I can't retire. That I can't build a new life with Shizuka until I've laid to rest all the demons that plagued the old one.
And that's why you tried to kill her with your bare hands?
Wouldn't you?
A thundering column of flame suddenly mushroomed from the temple. Rolling balls of orange-red fire billowed up into the blue sky, and burning debris was hurled in all directions. The former slaves cried out and retreated, backing away toward the jungle. Domi looked at the monstrous, crackling pyre roaring into the dawn sky.
Looks like this mission wasn't a waste of time after all.
Kane squinted away from the roaring flames and glanced down. Baron Beausoleil was gone. He stared unblinkingly at the ground, then looked back toward the fire.
I'm not so sure.
As the Barons cling tenuously to their waning influence over nuke-shattered America, a new threat emerges, armed with an intimate knowledge of pre-dark technology. To meet this threat, a cryogenically preserved team of fighting men has been reactivated, Team Phoenix. Their first mission is to secure and protect the Cerberus Redoubt and the Mattrans Network. Kane and his fellow exiles must convince Team Phoenix that they are all on the same side. Freedom for Skydark survivors from lives of misery and enslavement to the hybrids and their human allies. Outlander's Sea of Plague is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2003, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Kate Torrey, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Dan Smith. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton, Dan Smith, and Matt Webb. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Chris Rowan and Nathaniel Perry. Hindi translations by Minoti Kalita and Kior Shah, MD. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Deathlands 70, Vengeance Trail.
Spread out.
Ryan Carter. Gunned down and left for dead by the new provisional U.S. Army. A ruthless force commanded by a brilliant general with a propensity for casual mass murder.
Kill them all!
And a vision to rebuild America.
This will be a new country!
Waging war from a pre-dark, fusion-powered armored locomotive, this man is about to unlock the secrets of the gateways. As the rest of Ryan's group stand powerless. Except for one. Hope may be lost for Christy Roth, but for her, revenge is enough.
This fucker's chilled meat. Chilled meat.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, Download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.